Morning, everyone. Brady Porritt, nice to have you here, and Rich, welcome. And I feel like you put more pressure on me here, being here, and I've got to up my game. also quite different seeing everybody from this perspective. It's really wonderful what's happened here in the church building, and thanks so much to everyone that's been involved in that. So, get all my stuff ready here. On the 4th of June 1940, Winston Churchill addressed Parliament, and obviously we're in the throes of the Second World War, and he gave his favourite, or a famous speech, and I've listened to his speech, and it's said in a very matter-of-fact, kind of low tone, that was quite sort of charismatic of Winston Churchill. But I'm going to read it to you, of what he said, and you'll see how it ties into my message. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France, and we shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets, and we shall fight on the hills. We shall never surrender. I mean, even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island, or a large part of it, was subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to rescue and the liberation of the old. So we're in a series at the moment, Ready I Ready, going talking about being on mission. And so when I got allocated this date, we didn't actually have a title for today's sermon. And I woke up one morning and I spoke to Tony about it, and I just had on my mind that God had given me this message. Our ultimate mission is total surrender. So in contrast to the mission of Churchill here, where he's saying is, we will never surrender. Our ultimate mission really, as Christians, is total surrender. And about 4 or 5 years later, after Churchill's speech, the British or the Allied forces demanded absolute surrender from the Nazis. They would not negotiate. There was a lot of talk around whether they should do this or not, because it would cost more lives to put the Nazis into a position where there was no negotiation. It was complete and total surrender, and because they wanted no remnant. And so it is with us, that in order for us to be God's instruments, we need total surrender. And I just asked, what does surrendering to God mean? And if we break it up into mind, body and soul, because that's essentially our whole beings, what does total surrender mean? And if we go to Corinthians 2, verse 16, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 16, it says, if we just start with our mind, so again, mind, body, and soul. For who has known the mind of the Lord so as to instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ. And in Romans 12, verse 2, it says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. So we've got to realize that God doesn't think like we think. And in order for our minds to work in conjunction with God, we need to surrender our minds completely. And so if we go into the next stage is our bodies. And if we look at 1 Corinthians 6, verses 19 and 20, it says that, do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. So just continuing with that theme, going from our minds to our bodies aren't our own. They're a vessel for God to use. And it's important for us to understand that we surrender our bodies in every way to God, and ask for His will to be done through our bodies. And finally, if we consider our hearts or our soul and our spirit, you know, your soul never dies. That's the scary part. So you might lose your life here on earth, but your soul, it doesn't die. So there was, at the evening we had on the Saturday night, yeah, there was that guy that had an incredible conversion, and his ministry was just going up to people and saying, if you die tomorrow, where are you going? You know, and I think that's the scary part, is that there's no middle ground. It's heaven or hell. And so it's so important that we completely commit our hearts and our souls to God. And I chose a passage from Job 11:13-15. It says, if you devote your heart to him, your heart and soul, and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then free of faults, you will lift up your face and you will stand firm and without fear. So, just going through scriptures there of understanding what it means to completely surrender our minds, bodies and souls to the Lord. It really sums up also in Galatians 2:20, where it says, I've been crucified with Christ and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. So I've been crucified with Christ, I no longer live. You know, the amazing thing about surrendering in a military situation, and I've often thought about it, is, and it sort of, it got brought home for me in reading a book called Unbroken. And I don't know if any of you have read it. I actually couldn't finish it because I got so upset by the atrocities that the guys were suffering in the prisoner of war camps that I battled to sleep. And so Andrea read the book, so I'm a bit of a winky puff. My sister's read the book, but I got about halfway through it, but I don't understand what he's going through. Louis Zamperini. So Louis Zamperini was the most unbelievable athlete. The feeling is that if war hadn't broken out, that he probably would have been the guy that had broken the 4-minute mile. And just an incredible guy, and went through hell during the war, and came out of the war and had an incredible conversion at a Billy Graham crusade. But that fear for me of being in a military situation where you actually now have no other option than to surrender. To be honest, I would probably prefer to die. I think I would rather just fight to the end and not take that chance of falling into the wrong hands and falling into evil hands. And so one asks, I suppose, is what does it mean to completely surrender to God? You know, what are you allowing yourself to be exposed to, I suppose, as you would in a situation like that? And I chose two scriptures that I think just put in perspective. And the first is Jeremiah 29:11-13. Many of you know it well. It says, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you a hope and a future. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. So you're surrendering yourself to someone that has got, to the Almighty God, that's got incredible plans for you and has got your best interests at heart. So can you imagine in that situation, in the war, I mean, the situation in which you've now put the white flag up, and the people that take you and feed you and look after you and love you and try and work out what the best plan is for you to get home, because that's essentially what God's doing, is working out the best plan for you and the work you have to do before going home to be with him in heaven. The other is Isaiah 55:8-9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So, in surrendering your mind to Christ, you're surrendering yourself, your mind, to higher thoughts, because God's thoughts are not like your thoughts. And in surrendering everything to him, you're allowing his thoughts to take control of your destiny. But it's complete surrender. that can't be some of your thoughts and some of God's thoughts, although I suppose that does happen, and we do that all the time. But ideally what you want to do is to let God's thoughts become your thoughts, and to open your mind to that. And so, as you guys have become used to me, I like to look at quite practical sort of events in my own life that I feel that God's spoken to me, and that I hope I can share with you that will also highlight certain things. But in preparing for this, and I've really enjoyed preparing for this, God gave me a vision of a Formula One car on a farm track, on a farm road. And as a youngster, I loved cars. I got the car magazine from, I think, about 9. I was subscribed. And even at boarding school, my car magazine used to arrive. And Formula One Ferrari is actually my favorite. But there was this Ferrari, and we used to lease a St. John's farm just outside Howick for our oxen and our heifers. And there were big drains in this road. And literally without a bucky and preferably a 4x4, it was actually awkward to get up this road. And so in this vision I had, there's this Formula One car on this road and literally can't go anywhere. And I spent some time thinking about this, and it could have literally been the Sunday before. So say this is a Monday. On the Sunday, that car could have been in Monaco, being driven by Vettel as a Ferrari, and winning the world championships, or winning certainly that Grand Prix, being watched by millions and millions of people, possibly, I don't know about billions, but certainly millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people watching, both on TV and live. And this incredible work of art, literally the pinnacle of motoring technology, just on display, and an incredible athlete driving this car, finds herself now on a farm road where it literally is useless. And I'd sort of imagine this farmer who hadn't seen it. Imagine he hadn't watched the Grand Prix and found this thing on the road, thinking, we just watched the guys must be crazy again with the kids. I don't know if you guys, I mean, I watched it probably 40 years ago, but I mean, it's still so funny. But the guy goes, ay, 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 every time something goes wrong. And I can imagine this farmer looking at this and thinking, what is this thing doing on this road? And who would have made this thing? It's just like, it's hopeless. It can't even get over a bump. I mean, the way the engine works, it probably wouldn't get enough power to actually start on that hill. And yet, in the right place, it would be like you have the world's attention. And so, in the same way, if you took the tractor from the farm and put it on the Formula One track, it would be also pretty unspectacular. So it'd probably be more useful, but it would really be unspectacular. And I think really what I'm trying to get at is that God's made each of us in a specific way. And obviously there's two extremes. There's the Formula One car and the tractor that we're talking about now. But there's so many things in between that. And if you're not allowing yourself, and everybody sitting here is really a $1 billion machine, because it's impossible to recreate you and to recreate you how God made you. And so in allowing yourself, in surrendering to God in every way, you allow Him to put you in the space that you're supposed to be and allow you to be everything that you're supposed to be, so that the Formula One car can shine on the track and the tractor can shine on the farm field. Now, I'm going to digress a little bit. I'll be honest with you, I take more pleasure nowadays in watching a tractor working hard in the field than I do in a Ferrari on the racetrack. But for those of you that don't know, I actually own a Lamborghini. But listen to the end of the story to explain that. And this is a bit of history and just a bit of fun. So Enzo Ferrari was quite a young man, and he was highly successful. He was producing probably the finest sports cars in the world. And Mr. Lamborghini, this is a true story, I'm not making any names up, Mr. Lamborghini and Mr. Ferrari. Mr. Lamborghini came from a farming family. They farmed grapes. And he wasn't that interested in farming. He was more interested in the mechanical side of farming. So he made implements and he made tractors. And you will see Lamborghini tractors. I've got a little model Lamborghini tractor. But he started making quite a lot of money. And so what do you do when you make quite a lot of money? You buy a sports car, or a couple of sports cars. So off he went, and he bought the latest model from Enzo Ferrari, and he drove it home, and he started using it, and he started having issues. And being a mechanical guy, he started making notes for Enzo as to what was wrong with his car. And the clutch in particular was a problem. So he sent it to Enzo twice, to get repaired. On the third time, he and the tractor mechanic, because obviously quite handy, pulled this thing apart to find that the clutch that Enzo Ferrari was using in his Ferraris was the same clutch they used in the tractors. He was rather upset about this, so he went off to see Enzo with these notes and explained to him what he was doing wrong with his racing cars. And Enzo Ferrari said, "You make tractors, I make racing cars. You go back to the farm, I'll carry on making racing cars." 3 months later, Mr. Lamborghini produced his first car, and the rest, I suppose, is history. Lamborghini never really has reached the heights of Ferrari. Ferrari is often quoted as the most powerful brand in the world, just out of interest. But I'll tell you why I own a Lamborghini. It's because I've got a tractor that that was originally made by Lamborghini. And so when we bought it, they kept a Lamborghini engine. So I was very chuffed when this thing arrived. It's still going strong. And I said to Andrea, "I bet you never thought you'd be married to a guy who owned a Lamborghini." But she wasn't that impressed. But the reason I'm just telling these stories is just to really emphasize that if you're outside of God's will, it doesn't matter what you are, and that the fact that you are a billion-dollar machine sitting here is that you're just not going to be doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're just not going to reach the heights, I believe, that God wants you to do. And that's why I say it doesn't need to be spectacular. I mean, as I say, it might be the tractor plowing the field as opposed to the Formula One car. But I just feel that if everybody in the church could be in that space, it would just be the most incredible synergy. And so I've had more personal experiences with this. And when I was at school, I suddenly found myself in this leadership position to lead the school, which was quite unexpected. It was just a whole sequence of events that happened. And because of how the events happened, I hadn't been exposed to the leadership structures prior to me suddenly being appointed to this position. And it's quite a task. You have 500 odd boys looking for leadership. You have teachers looking towards you for leadership. You have parents and old boys looking. There's an expectation of what you need to do, and there's an enormous amount of pressure. And leadership models have changed over the last few years, but particularly then there was a really one really needed to be like a bit of a figurehead and sort of stamp your authority, so to speak. And I was finding it very difficult, and I was finding myself out of my depth. And one day, this was probably in the first 10 days, which was fortunate, because I got back to my little cottage, and I opened the door, and this letter, which I've kept next to my bed in a folder that I've got of special letters that I've received through my life, this was under my door. And I picked it up, and I sat down, and I read it. And it was a teacher written it to me, Joanne Fenter, who hadn't actually ever taught me. She was a French teacher, and I took French in Form 1 because we had to, and I wasn't very good at it. But we knew each other from Christian Fellowship. And it's quite a personal letter, and it's quite long, so I'm not going to read the whole thing. But essentially, she felt prompted by God to write to me. And I read a paragraph that's quite significant and I think makes sense in context of this sermon. It says, "Dear Tim, yours is not an easy job, as I'm sure you're aware. And if you try to do it in your own strength, you will fail." And underlined "will." "But if you do it in God's strength, always asking Him to lead you and guide you, you will," underlined, "succeed. Do not let Hosea 10:13 be your verse." And then there was a whole lot of other things about servant leadership and the way to lead according to God's principles and according to Jesus' example. And it was something that changed my life, because I sat down and I realized that I couldn't do this. And the only way I could do this was to allow myself to be a vessel and allow God to work through me. And that's what I started to do and to learn. Mainly because I didn't have any other choice. And through my life, I've found, and those of you close to me will often find me feeling like I'm at a place where you're almost out of your depth. And every time you get to that point, it's another situation in which you're able to just reconfirm that you've got to allow yourself to be a vessel and allow God's will and to surrender completely to God. And so just out of interest, Hosea 10:13, which was not to be my verse, just so you guys know, it says, but you have planted wickedness, you have reaped evil, you have eaten the fruit of deception, because you have depended on your own strength and on your many warriors. So again, an example of what happens when you rely on your own strength and not God's strength, and not letting God's will be done in your life, and not surrendering. Got a final couple of examples, just practical things that happened to me. I know, and those of you that have had to prepare messages, I'm sure we often have common ground in this. Strange things start happening in your week before. And so it was a really busy week. I currently find myself with the work that I'm doing. I love it, but it's an enormous amount of work, and it's a full load. I always say full load, full throttle. And on Friday, I was coming to the end of my day, and it was about 4:30, and I really wanted to go home and see Anne and the kids, and I couldn't find my wallet, and I'm quite bad at using things and stuff, but my wallet I've become quite good at, because it's got so many important things in it, and it started to worry me, and so I suddenly just got into my zone now of how I'm going to find this thing. So I got in my truck and I quickly drove to the office before the gate closed, and I got to the office there, and then there's a glass door that I don't have a key to, so I couldn't get up to the office. So I phoned the guy that owns the restaurant, and he happened to be having a birthday party for his wife, but I was able to sound as convincing enough that he shot down the road and opened the glass door, and then I ran up to the office and I went through the office and my wallet wasn't there. And I'm very disappointed. I went down the stairs, got into the car, said thank you very much to the guy. I buy a lot of coffee there, so I think that's partly why I think he came to help me. But I then got to the stop street, and I basically surrendered the situation. I said to the Lord, Lord, please just help me find my wallet. I hadn't actually stopped and done that. And it was incredible. I turned right. I went over the first speed hump, and I thought to myself, I should phone the bookkeeper, because she was in the office when I came back from that meeting, and she would have seen if I had my wallet. And as I thought that, I honestly felt like God saying, but it's in your laptop bag. And I'd had the laptop bag at the previous meeting. So literally I drove back to my office. There it was in my laptop bag. And I was really getting quite excited now about leaving the office. And an email came through. Excuse me. And presumed it was something for the weekend or whatever, and it wasn't. It was a really important email at 4:35, which I think is a little bit offside, from the finance guys of the project. And I mean, bearing in mind, everybody in the building industry basically closed on Friday. And it was a very simple one line. Dear Tim, please audit the attached spreadsheet and revert ASAP. Okay, so you know what that's going to be like. So I open the spreadsheet and I look at the final sheet. And I can see that there's my numbers and there's their numbers and there's an 8 cents difference. And now we've been going for 6 months. It's a relatively big project. There's all sorts of money flows that go all over the place. And those of you that worked with numbers will know that finding 8 cents, it doesn't really matter whether it's 8 cents or 100 grand or 1,000 rand. It doesn't balance, you know. And it's a little bit like sin, I suppose. It's, you know, this like sin. So, and also, it'll never just be 8 cents. It'll be 1 cent here or 4 cents there, or maybe it's like a minus 4 cents, so then in the minus, it's like a double negative, that becomes an 8, and you're looking for all sorts of things. It can take a long time. And so I just sat there and said, please, Lord, man, I won't sleep this weekend unless I know where this problem is. And it felt almost like supernatural. I pulled my workings up. That the lady that helps me has been so great in setting up, and I started comparing numbers, and within, I'd say, 10 minutes, I'd found two cells in the spreadsheet that had the incorrect number. One was overstated by 2 cents, and one was understated by 10 cents, and so that made the 8 cents, and I then checked the others, and I felt like a genius, and went back, and I actually re-put it into the spreadsheet just to make sure it added up to 8. I know that sounds so elementary, but when you're tired and those sorts of things, it adds up. And so I wrote a quick email. I just said, on a very brief examination of the spreadsheet, but considering that it had been sent to 3 other people before it had come to me, I see that there appears to be an error in cell L 15 and L 18 on sheet, whatever, you know. But I'll double check on Tuesday with the bookkeeper. Have a wonderful weekend. It was just such a relief, but it sort of felt to me that I was almost just allowing God to use my mind. And it just, I know it doesn't always work like that, but it just felt like it. And it just felt incredible to be able to say that and to be able to drive out of my office and go home and not worry about the 8 cents. But anyway, just some practical little stories and just to strengthen what I'm hoping that I'll get through in this message. I wrote this, I'm coming to the end here now, and I just want to just re-emphasize really what we're saying. We're talking about being on mission for God, and really in order for us to be everything that we want to be on that mission, we need to surrender. So surrender is really our ultimate mission in order for us to be on mission. If that's so, inward submission and surrender. So I wrote this at about 11:30 at night. It seemed quite profound when I wrote it. Read it a few times more, but I still think it makes sense as a conclusion. So I said, in total surrender, we achieve the ultimate victory that allows us to be on the ultimate mission to live the life God intended us to live. In living our lives as God intended, we will shine powerfully and ultimately souls will be saved, the ultimate prize and God's deepest desire. Anyway, that's the end of my sermon, but I just really want to encourage you now as we go into this time of Christmas, of Christ's time, of considering that little babe as we did during worship, and considering why he came and leaving us after his death and leaving us with the Holy Spirit to guide us. I really challenge you to understand how big that gift was from God that will enable you to be everything that God intended for you to be.